All right, so another episode of Inside Out, and we're at Verdian Corporation.
Yes.
And who are you?
I'm the CTO and Vice President of Product Development. Mm-hmm. Here in beautiful downtown Seattle, and yet another overcast sunny day.
I know. Isn't it summer? I don't get it.
It's summer. It's all we get. What can we ask for?
I don't know. So let me ask you, what do you guys do?
Verdian makes one core software product mm-hmm. that helps organizations save power on their PCs. We do that by basically providing a framework for companies and organizations to turn off their PCs or put them into standby when they're not needed. Hmm. And it all sounds really straightforward,
sure.
From first glance, but as it turns out, with corporations that are doing nighttime maintenance or software installations that have users that are distributed all over the place, some systems need to be on 24 hours a day because their servers have important capabilities, others are notebook computers,
sure.
People with multiple desktops and trading stations and all those types of things. There are really radically different requirements for different parts of organizational PCs. Mm-hmm. Verdian makes it possible for these large organizations to set policies on groups of computers based upon how they're actually used, mm-hmm. understand the cost implications of different sets of policies. For example, for computers that are in very light use in an organization, but that are on 24 hours a day, you can save maybe 23 hours of that otherwise wasted energy because they're only in use for a little bit of time. And so our software is able to detect situations like that and figure out how they can make the types of settings to be able to put them into low power states. Now, on the other side of it, of course, is it's more than just the end users who are interacting with PCs. It's IT who are doing patching and maintenance. And mm-hmm. at nighttime, IT organizations need to be able to turn machines on again.
Absolutely.
So that they can do their virus scans, software updates, and so forth. So our software provides capabilities to do that and to integrate into the often the IT environments so that it's almost transparent that the PCs are off or in standby when they're not needed.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, that brings up, a question of what's the vision behind the company? Sounds like you're all about energy efficiency.
We are about energy efficiency. We're about managing, helping IT manage the power states and energy efficiency of the systems in their environment. And in another aspect of that, though, is just it's not just energy efficiency; it's cost savings. Mm. And underlying cost savings is straightforward administration. So that one problem that happens in a lot of organizations is that some users decide to turn their PCs off, and in the middle of the night, and IT can't get them on without visiting a building, sometimes four states or a whole continent away.
Absolutely.
So it's more than just power savings. It's
sure.
making it possible for organizations to take advantage of power savings and still make that work for them and save the resulting costs.
So that, if a PC is turned off, but it's plugged into the wall, what you're saying is there's some way to turn it back on?
Most PCs, especially most modern PCs, if they're on a network, can be configured in a way such that there's this thing called a wake on LAN packet.
Got it.
And if it's a certain pattern of network traffic, that if it arrives on that PC's network interface, is enough to turn the PC on, as long as it has power.
Excellent.
Now, that again sounds really straightforward, but the way that packet is set up, it needs to be broadcast on the local network segment. And in large corporations, they don't allow broadcasts from segment to segment of their networks because mm-hmm. they've been the cause of all sorts of terrible Trojan worms and things like that. Been underlying the cause of terrible Trojan worms and things like that. And so one of the capabilities of our software is to be able to, in a very large enterprise, still be able to turn on PCs without requiring that broadcast to be sent to, to be sent across network segments so that it can be done locally instead.
Interesting.
So, yeah, you can turn them on, but, it's not as easy as it sounds up front. And we do that by having some machines on each network segment stay awake so that the centralized command points are able to tell them, hey, wake up somebody on your local network segment.
So it's sort of like a peer network, in a sense. You have a node that will transmit to its...
Yeah, it's similar to peers. It's more of a proxy. Since I can't do that work, since the server can't do that work locally, I'll recruit somebody to do it for me. So it's not that the peers are communicating with each other. It's very clearly, a hierarchical structure. But we keep control where we need to in the local network.
Excellent. So it sounds to me that, this software resides where? So in other words, it's installed on each of the clients as a Windows service in the case of Windows, perhaps?
Yes, yes, absolutely. It's a little lightweight client written in C++. It runs as a service. Mm-hmm. And it has two roles. One of them is to enforce policies. They need some intelligence to do that. It needs to be able to do that when it's not connected to the network, because people take home their notebook computers and shut the lids and go into standby and things like that. When systems shut down, it needs local intelligence to be able to manage the shutdown or the policy enforcement, various capabilities of the product. Uh-huh. The service itself has another piece, which is to actually watch to see what power states the computer is in. One of the critical components of what we do is we call it measurement and verification. Hmm. And it's to actually take real world measurements of when the machines are on, when the monitors are on and off, when the PC is on and standby or off, and also information about who's interacting with the PC. Is there a person that is wiggling the mouse or pressing keys on the keyboard there in front of it? Hmm. So the client captures that type of information and sends it up to the server, where we can do analytics and reporting. We can actually tell a customer. Often we'll go into an organization before they're using our software, install the client, not make any policy settings at all, and just watch who's interacting with the machines and when they're on. And then we take data from that and can simulate and say, if you used such and such a power policy or set of power policies on these machines, how much money would we save? And we can turn it into a hard dollar figure. You will, with your 40,000 PCs, save $3 million per year by using this power policy.
That's awesome.
We show them graphs and what the results are. You see on weekends, of course, that most of the machines and monitors are all off. And then during the weekdays, we see lunchtime. You can see from 11:30 p.m. to 1 p.m. that people use the PC less. And if an organization is really adamant about saving power, there's a great opportunity, even during an hour-long lunch, to cut down, maybe 5 hours a week out of the amount of time that system is on and, consuming energy. And the other side of energy consumption is that it's always tied, wherever we generate power, except for in the dams around here, there's CO2 emitted into the air.
Absolutely.
And so that the organizational's carbon footprint is related to how much energy they consume. And if they're wasting energy because PCs aren't on all the time, then they actually have a larger carbon footprint and are emitting essentially more carbon dioxide than they would be if they had those same machines off.
Absolutely. I mean, and of course you have a different set of problems, for example, in a data center. Let's say MSN or something, some big giant data center.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm sure your software is very useful there, but those guys have to keep running. So you have to cycle through, right?
There are a lot of extra concerns in data centers because they're...
But they use a lot of power.
They use a ton of power. And data centers are their own interesting world because the operators are so risk-averse. And generally, they're paid to make sure systems are on 24/7. And so even putting a system into a standby state or turning it off is something that it takes a lot of kind of organizational impetus to really want to do, to save that kind of power. As an aside, Verdiem is a member of this organization called the Green Grid. Hmm. And one of the purposes of the Green Grid was actually formed to look at the problem of data center power management. Yeah. In these meetings, we have representatives from all of the main players that both contribute or have pieces sell into data center market, but also big data center operators. Microsoft is a member, actually.
Sure.
Of course, their MSN group. And this group is actually looking at the organizational barriers and technical barriers to being able to reduce energy consumption of the data centers. Hmm. Of course, one of the issues with MSN is it's sized for the worst case of the heaviest load in there. There's probably a lot of systems that are running there that are up and running that are doing almost nothing for a vast portion of the time, just because there's no user interacting with them. Now they're ready when the Super Bowl comes on or when there's some huge news event, so that millions of users are going to hit them all at the same time. So they're ready to respond to that load. Mm-hmm. But if you were able to scale back the number of systems that are operating in the data center, you could save that energy directly.
Sure. And it sounds like you could have some sort of service that could manage that automatically. Like,
absolutely.
A big load is coming. Clearly that happens anyway, right? You're going to have servers that are going to be able to fire up.
Right. Right, absolutely.
So, but I mean, it's all interesting because I mean, obviously, the important thing to think about for the next who knows how long is global warming. Yeah. So you mentioned CO2. So this is very important stuff.
It is.
And so let's talk a little bit about the implementation details to some degree. I mean, sure. You mentioned C++, great language. One of the questions that immediately came to mind when you talked about a service and dealing with policies was the, how has your experience been upgrading to Vista? I mean, has it been sort of with our new security model? I'm sure you've probably spent time doing the compatibility tests and
right.
What's that been like?
It was a change of substance to the sure. to the way the core product worked. And one of the main issues was that that we sometimes show a dialog box to an end user. Mm-hmm. And prior to Vista, you were able to, from a service, interact with the desktop and say, "Hey, we have some system-wide things going on."
Yeah.
Under Vista, when a service wants to interact with a user, it does so in a completely separate space.
Yeah.
And it pops up a desktop, and it looks like some terrible thing is happening in the computer. Yeah. You're able to still see the message, but that's obviously not the kind of experience we want our end users to have.
Sure.
So we had to make some shifts in the architecture so that there's a component that runs out of the context, under the security context of each user logged into the system.
Mm-hmm.
And then that component communicates with the service through comm interfaces
okay.
so that the service can indicate to the local security context, "Hey, I need you to pop up a dialog box," or "I need you to interact with the user in this way."
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of it, of course, is just to be able to understand whether the user is interacting. We need some capability in the local security context of each logged in users to notice what they're doing.
Sure.
So it was a shift in the architecture. It's something that we already had a framework for, but we moved a couple of control points around.
Sure.
And then the whole installation process, of course, was somewhat changed. And it's a maturing both of Microsoft's offering in terms of kind of getting very serious about security and dividing up the places where control points can be.
Absolutely.
Who can do what to harm the operating system. So it was a good thing for us, too, because we're, of course, in big corporations, financial organizations. They care so much about security and have so many regulations that cover them that we need to be all over it ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, that brings up a good point. I mean, you are running as a Windows service, and I'm, in reality, running probably as admin context on the older versions.
Right.
Like in Vista, no one admin means something different than it did in any of our other operating systems.
Right, yeah.
So that's an interesting challenge for you guys to do your security auditing and run through your tools. And you have the same situation we have as well, because you're writing unmanaged code.
Right.
And that's where the buffer overruns, integer overflows, and all those things that can happen when you're bare down to the metal. So could your stuff run in managed code?
It could. We have chosen to not do so up to this point, primarily because we have a lot of customers that value a very small footprint. If you can envision in the retail space, there's Windows XP Embedded Edition,
sure.
which is just a stripped-down version of Windows XP that runs on cash registers. And in fact, Microsoft has been very successful winning that marketplace over. I've heard that the vast majority of point-of-sale systems are now running Windows XP Embedded.
Excellent.
And that's good for Microsoft. Great company.
So
they like a really light footprint. So running on a managed code in that environment isn't very pragmatic. And for us to have, three or four different versions of our product and on our managed code and so forth isn't pragmatic for us.
Sure.
We need to keep more fleet and nimble than that. So up to this point, we're sticking with the C++ based tight service. I will say that we're planning work to provide more end user feedback. Up till recently, most organizations have not wanted to involve the end user in power management decisions. They've wanted to just have it happen, like IT shops, just like, "We'll just turn them off and tell the users we're going to turn them off."
Yeah.
Now there's, with a kind of a new environmental awareness, we're finding that employees of companies are wanting their organizations to be more green. It's almost like a benefit, or like, "I want my company to be green and to not waste energy."
Absolutely.
And because of that, we're getting people in IT that come to us and say, "We want end users to be able to have more aggressive power settings than we do. And we want to inform them about the implications of their choices. We want them to say, 'Hey, you helped us save this much money,' or you reduce this much carbon dioxide from being emitted into the atmosphere and so forth.
Absolutely.
And we're doing a lot of that work in, or we're planning most of that work in managed code. It's so much easier to do UIs in C# and and to make them really, really compelling.
Absolutely. I mean, WPF, for example, could make it pretty compelling. But that's a really interesting point. I it'd be nice if Microsoft, for example, would be doing some more of this work. Like, I know sometimes I leave my computer on, and I know we are pretty much a green company. We have a lot of people at the company who care about the environment, right? Or just to care about energy consumption and CO2 creation. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are the issues, like particularly with Windows, where you have automatic updates, where or you have a long-running process. So in other words, the policy, say as a software developer, right? Say I'm doing a build before I go home. And the policy that IT has set is turn this computer off after, 2 a.m. But I start my build at 1 because I work late.
Right.
And it's not going to get done until, whatever. Right. It depends on what I'm building.
Yeah, right, right.
What's the modification for the user to say, okay, I mean, I guess my real question is, if IT sets policy, then should the user be able to override it? And is there that kind of granularity in your stuff?
Yeah, we deal with all sorts of different types of organizations, some of whom want to dictate policy and not have end users be able to interact with it at all. Others of whom, are happy to let end users make their own choices. So we offer that kind of administrative flexibility where, the IT or the centralized IT can say, we want this policy, but we're going to let the end user choose to extend the amount of time, like rather than have it go to sleep at a particular time, have it not go to sleep that night, or delay it by a certain number of hours or what have you. Mm-hmm. The other side of it, though, is that frequently we'll just use idleness of the computer to determine whether it should stand by.
Cool.
So if a computer isn't, like your build is going to be using the CPU and it's going to be using the hard drive, and your system is going to look like somebody's working on it, even though there's not, it's doing work even though there's not somebody interacting directly
cool.
with it. And so we find that the idle timeouts are really valuable. And most organizations end up setting policies just based on idle time.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's good, because that kind of makes it clear that if IT says you shut all computers down, at 9 o'clock, and most people shouldn't work past 9, but most people do in the software industry.
Yeah.
But shut them all down at 9, obviously if I'm typing or whatever, doesn't happen. I mean, that's important to understand.
There's a little dial. That's one of those dialogue boxes that can come up to say, "Hey,
but
IT says you should, the system should be shut down now," and it gives you the opportunity to say, "Nope, I'm doing something."
Yeah, that happens on Windows, for example, with when it's going to install an update.
Yeah, right.
You get this thing. We're shutting your computer down in 15 minutes.
Absolutely.
Like, no, not now. But if you happen to leave and your build is running, it will actually cut off and restart.
Yeah, that's one of the use cases that people get really concerned about. What if my computer's doing something when it cuts time for this hard reboot?
Cool. Where you got, you guys are smart enough not to shut me down, so that's cool.
Now we need to smarten up the Windows Update service.
Yeah, we do. You hear that, guys?
No,
but they have a hard problem
for you. And actually, if you guys want to talk about Microsoft buying our product, we're all over that. I think it serve you well.
I agree. I mean, we've actually had this debate on emails on my specific team about the notion of how much energy people are using while they're not at work. I mean, many of us have more than one computer.
Right.
And I know for a fact that I leave mine on because, I might want to, which is an interesting point. If I'm in London, for example, or wherever traveling, might want to razz into my machine.
Mm-hmm.
Get on my... Somebody's like, Charles, we need to do this or that.
Right.
Now, with your LAN wake-up packet program, that, of course, is already supported to some degree in Vista, I believe, or... I don't know if it's...
Yeah, with limits.
With limits.
there's always pragmatic limits in any of these things where you turn the machines on and off.
Sure.
Yeah. So the way we tend to approach that is either through integration directly into the software. Mm-hmm. And as of Vista, actually, Microsoft has extended the API for the remote terminal services.
Sure.
Connection or RDP.
RDP
protocol.
Okay.
And they've provided a framework so that we could actually hook into that and wake up the machine when somebody's trying to RDP into it. Before the Vista version of it, though, which is vast majority of our customers right now. Mm-hmm. There needs to be some other framework for doing it. So we provide a web-based tool where you can go and say, wake my machine up, and then RDP into it. It's an extra step. But on the other side of it, most people, you would either choose to have their PC running all the time, mm-hmm. so that they don't have to do that step, or they're maybe infrequently using RDP, and they may be feeling a little guilty about leaving their dual-core Xeon workstation with two monitors running all the time during a trip to Europe.
Sure.
So it provides an opportunity for people and organizations who are willing to, to make the choices to save energy, to have a tool and a framework for doing it.
So, on the one hand, you could also set policy to where everyone must disable the ability to turn off the sleep.
Yeah.
Right. If you have a running Windows, you can just say, with the policy, I would imagine, you can't tell it not to go to sleep. Right?
No, that's certainly one option. Yeah.
Okay. And you guys are doing a similar thing, obviously much more complicated and intelligent than that, but...
Yeah, well, in general, a lot of our organizations, again, we give the administrators the flexibility because different types of organizations do different things. But in general, our administrators choose to let their end users control the short term.
Sure.
What they do. Like, don't go to sleep. They say, let them do that.
Yeah.
But then when the next time for switching a power profile comes, when it comes time to be the nighttime profile, their setting would be reset. It would go back to the default.
Sure.
I've even on my computer, sometimes I'll be giving a presentation and I'll set it so never sleep.
Yeah.
And I find that if I say never sleep, then it basically means that I might leave my computer open and the battery will be dead when I come back to it. And
absolutely.
I wish I could have just said, don't sleep for the next hour. I really need you right now.
Yeah.
And so those kind of tools and frameworks are really important to make this pragmatic in a large organization.
Absolutely.
Or for the individual, for that matter, for me.
Yeah. So if my computer's been idle for an hour, I'm not using it.
Right.
Go to sleep. Right. Save some energy.
Yep, absolutely.
That's awesome. And now let's talk about how do you turn this into dollars and cents? And what kind of math are you using? How do you determine the kilowatt hours? And that's an interesting...
Sure. Well, we have a kind of a library or an understanding of how different types of computers, how much energy at the idle that different types of computers and different kinds of monitors use. Mm. And so when we work with a customer to understand like what their mix of types of computers are, we kind of get an understanding of how much power do their systems consume. Then we go into the organization and take baseline measurements and say, when are these computers on and off? So we can kind of multiply. It's like, well, when they're in idle mode, they take, say, 60, 65 watts of power. When they're in standby mode, they might take 5 watts, and when they're off, they might take 2. Hmm. When the monitor's on, it might take 80 watts, and when it's off, it might take, or when it's in standby or sleep, it might take 5. And you can take the differences between those different power states and then overlay that via simulation of what the behavior of the machine would have been based on the user activity in the past, major user activity, and literally turn it into you would have saved this many kilowatt hours per PC per year. Then you multiply, it's much more detailed than that because each PC's savings potential is different because some people turn their PC off at night every time before they go home. So obviously that machine will have a different savings potential than a person that leaves their machine on 24 hours a day. So we take those real measured numbers and what a power management profile would have done based on historical user behavior and can turn it into a very factual, like, you will save in your organization, an average of $27 per PC per year because your power costs 7 cents per kilowatt hour. And then multiply that times the whole organization and give them a very concrete number. But what we find is that after all the costs of doing the implementation and buying the software, that there's a payback for our system just in terms of pure kilowatt savings, kilowatt hour electricity savings of between 12 and 18 months. Then you start to factor in air conditioning costs, which we don't use in our return on investment calculation at all. But when these PCs are heating buildings, generally, there's cooling systems that are cooling off, and so there's extra overhead because all those watts turn into heat, and all that heat turns into heat that needs to be removed from the building.
Absolutely.
And even in a place like cold New York City, some of those big financial towers, they're cooling all the time because they have so much technology equipment and people in there that are generating heat. So you can have those kind of savings. And then there's a lot of softer savings, like efficiency of IT. Can they? How much does it cost IT to not be able to turn on a PC at 2 o'clock in the morning and do a security update that's critical for the next day? Or install some big piece of software? You know, these big financial firms drive a lot of their own software. They need everybody to be using the newest version the next morning. So there's some very concrete savings that don't come from energy management, but come from just being able to remotely turn on the PC and do the update when it happens.
Absolutely.
So hard dollars.
Absolutely. That's really hard cool. Dollars. So now you guys scale. I mean, it sounds like you started off as, you know, let's take a little bit about the history. You started off probably for small.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting history. It was the founder of the company's wife worked in an Oregon school district. And she was tasked with the job of finding some system that could turn off PCs when they're not in use. So she went out in the marketplace and looked around and saw what was available and saw that there was really nothing pragmatic for an organization like that to be able to, you know, control the power states of the computers. Now, one of our founders, Jim Tatham, he's an entrepreneur at heart and her husband. So he said, this is a good opportunity to start a company. And he was just in the midst of kind of looking around for opportunities. And so he got together with a couple other people that were motivated and solving a problem and ended up finding a couple of local customers in the Oregon area that were very interested in the product and went to the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance and got some seed funding, enough to get a company started and creating a product that would solve those kind of needs. And part of getting funding from the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance is that they needed to have ways of proving the savings so that the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance would be able to go to local companies and say, hey, here's a very concrete savings measure you can do. You know, install it in your company. And so just due to who the early investor was, we really focused early on measurement and verification. And that's turned out great because it's the demonstrable ROI, or cost savings from using this, ends up being really key to being able to sell into large corporations. They like the environmental benefits and maybe think they're really important, but unless it's really measurable and verifiable, they don't know what to do. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily take part in an initiative unless they can communicate the results of it. So anyway, the company kind of started off and had a few sites, you know, that were smaller in scale, maybe a couple thousand PCs, and the software product matured and it started selling pretty successfully into things like school districts and municipalities with, you know, on the order of thousands of machines. Nice. And then we started to get traction in some larger organizations like CUNY. City University of New York uses our product throughout their entire system, so that's like 27,000 PCs. And that we recognized very early on. I started the company about 2 years ago, right around the time when the people in it realized that they needed an enterprise product. They needed to bring in somebody that had experience creating and building products that sold into enterprise IT to deal with issues like security and the hierarchies in enterprise IT and how management was done. And you know, some of it comes down to just pure issues of software quality. Like, how do you create a commercial software company that can sell into the world's largest organizations? So we've just been growing on a pretty regular basis. It's been a fun ride. And now there's a lot of excitement because with all the attention toward greenhouse gas emissions affecting, you know, global warming and so forth, companies in the U.S. are taking it very seriously now.
Sure.
We've gone from only talking to facilities managers to start off with in companies who were paying the electrical bill, to talking to IT people who feel like they have a responsibility to the organization to help reduce their environmental footprint of the equipment that they were installing everywhere. So it's been an interesting shift and a lot of fun.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned U.S., but this is obviously a global problem. Are you guys in the global market?
We are. We are in the global market. And in fact, one of the things we have underway right now is there's enough demand. We're currently shipping in English language, but planning to support multiple different languages in the next version. And part of that is we're dealing with multinational corporations that have offices all around the world, and that in some cultures it's not great to have an English language client, even though it's a pretty small footprint client and there's not a lot of user interaction in the current shipping product. There will inevitably be more, and English language doesn't work well in Japan. And
exactly.
It's not well regarded in France and other places, and a lot of places can't read it. So we're seeing pressure to support multiple languages. And along with that, we have partner sales organizations around the world, and there's a lot of interest in our product. Europe has an interesting thing going on where they actually have a real greenhouse gas trading market. So it's called a CO2 trading market, where you can, if you do a project that can demonstrate savings in energy, you can create something that's of value to be traded. It's the right to emit carbon dioxide. And it actually has a tangible value, and it can be traded on an open market.
Huh.
And on top of that, Europe has been a little more concerned with CO2 emissions, you know, in the past few years than the U.S. has been.
Absolutely.
There's a number of governments there that have tax incentives for organizations that do energy efficiency programs. If they can show that they're saving energy over historical usage levels, that they actually get tax refunds or maybe compensation for it.
Mm.
And even in the U.S., where it's not so much an attention on CO2 emissions, we have a number of utility companies that actually will pay their customers rebates in order to, if they install and use our product.
Wow.
So pretty much along most of the West Coast and the East Coast, where there's a lot of attention paid to the ability to transmit power, most of the utilities in those areas will compensate customers. Like, you know, they'll pay a lot of the purchase price of the product to a customer that agrees to use it.
Excellent.
So even in the U.S. we see. And that's more just those power companies are trying to reduce the demand on the grid in real growth areas like the Northeast and the West Coast.
Mm. So, I mean, Microsoft is, you know, we call ourselves a platform company.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys write any sort of APIs for other developers to take advantage of so I could customize it as an enterprise developer?
We have limited APIs now. They're primarily in the control side. We want our capabilities to be able to integrate to things like, you know, well, for example, we have a product for SMS called SMS Wake Up, or Wake Up for SMS.
Okay.
And the idea there is that we use our own APIs and have a component that integrates to SMS so that if an SMS administrator has configured an advertisement to run at, say, 1 o'clock in the morning, our product figures out which PCs it's going to apply to and wakes them up in advance of that advertisement.
Hmm.
And then when they wake up, tells SMS, has the client tell the SMS server, hey, I'm ready to receive an update, gets the update, and then puts the machine to sleep. So there's an example of us eating our own dog food as the APIs to create a product. And then we run into different organizations that have similar needs where they may have a custom tool or some environment that they need to wake it up. And so we provide an API so that they can do similar things like a wake this client API or wake this group of clients or wake clients by this MAC address and be able to have that scale across the network.
Cool. Now, I mean, the basic hardware PC architecture, if you're a Mac or, you know, PC, or let's not look at the operating system per se, but in other words, you guys support more than just Windows. I mean, I would imagine there's going to be enterprises that have a large number of Macintosh. I mean, I hate to say that. Everyone should be using Windows, man. I'm just kidding. But so, you know, the fact that you've written it in C++, but it's a service on Windows is going to be
right.
Different than a service on a Mac.
Yeah,
obviously.
That's the case.
So are you guys work...
Well, I'll tell you, up to this point, we've found that the vast majority of our customers are using Windows.
Good.
And especially in the corporate space. Now, since we're really passionate about saving energy, we're not willing to just rest with a Windows-only solution forever.
Yeah.
But really, it's been the most effective thing for us right now to focus on the platform that, you know, 95% plus of businesses use on every PC and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and on 95% of the machines. But since we sold into academia, though, there are a lot more Macs, say, in some school districts and things like that.
Mm.
But even to control the Macs, a lot of them are older PCs. I mean, we're still supporting Windows 95 in some school districts.
Wow.
And Windows 98. Our last release supported Windows 98. So
amazing.
We're really struggling with some of the backward compatibility issues with those platforms. But we would have the same problem in the places where we see most Macs.
Mm.
But it's even worse because there's different architectures of the operating system of Mac OS. It hasn't always been, you know, OS X. There was about 5 different versions with different hardware capabilities and software interfaces. And so to get the kind of coverage of the whole Mac population in schools that we have for Windows would be a Herculean task.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make sense to us to do right now.
Sure.
It's natural in, you know, larger enterprises as we see. I mean, we're starting to see... and the Mac laptops running Windows starting to sell into a lot of corporations and being used to run Windows software.
Sure.
But But we know that those same laptops don't always run Windows software. Sometimes they're running Mac OS X. And we plan to cover that space too.
Interesting. So when your developers here are writing in, what do they use? Visual Studio 2005?
Yeah, we use Visual Studio 2005, and we have to use the newest Vista SDK. And the client's primarily in C, or client is in C++. Uh-huh. We use our database is Microsoft SQL Server. We support both 2000 and 2005. Mm. The server itself is written in C++ currently, and uses good old DCOM for a lot of its interfaces, and you know we're migrating away from that. But you know, because we've been around for a while, you know, some of that we've always adopted the recommended Microsoft technologies, so that when we go into customer sites, they don't see anything strange about what we're doing.
Sure.
So our reporting tool, we'd had one that was less enterprise scalable a year and a half ago. And we've recently adopted the Microsoft reporting services in order to provide reports to end users. Mm. So all that is written in C#, all under managed code, and using the components from Microsoft reporting services in order to create the product.
Interesting.
It's working quite well. We built an extensibility framework around it and kind of turned it into an application. In fact, we have a fat client version of it that doesn't need to have IIS or a web server installed at all. And that's been great for our customers. They can do the reporting where they need to and have very straightforward installation process for the whole system and not worry about web server administration and those type of things.
Absolutely. Excellent. That's good to hear.
It's good. Yeah, we're eating the Microsoft dog food, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, part of what we do inside out is we want to get, you know, see how you're doing and get your feedback. But, so that's sort of coming through.
Thanks for Visual Studio Service Pack 1. There's some feedback.
There you go. For Vista, you mean?
Oh, no, just in general, the Service Pack. Yeah, just Service Pack 1. We early on ran into a few hiccups that we know that the terrible reality of being a developer is that you can spend days trying to find a problem that you thought you caused when you find out it's actually just some problem in a compiler or a vendor problem or whatever.
Yeah.
Just a story of the life of a software developer.
Absolutely.
So we ran into a few of those being early adopters of Visual Studio 2005. And, you know, there were always, you know, usually critical fixes available for it and things like that. But Service Pack 1 seemed to have rounded things out.
Excellent. And, I mean, you guys are writing C++. What's your feedback? I mean, you have a lot of C++ videos on Channel 9. And those guys are evolving nicely.
Absolutely. You know, one piece of feedback is that even though Microsoft, I believe, is really pushing the managed code, and for good reason.
Sure.
There are a lot of software companies out there that are still needing to use C++. And maybe people developing code today, starting right now, that decide that C++ is the most appropriate language to use.
Sure.
And I know Microsoft has moved on and is trying to get everybody to adopt the managed code and buy into the C#.NET world.
Sure.
And I feel like some of the C++ interfaces are being left behind. So those of us who need to create, you know, enterprise software and core services and things like that are not getting nearly as much attention from Microsoft as otherwise. And I understand the underlying motivations in the marketplace. That Microsoft would love everybody to use its own technologies and kind of lock out the Linuxes and the Mac OSs of the world. Mm. But there's a lot of us who need to worry about cross-platform compatibility, and we would love to see the attention continue
absolutely.
On C++.
Well, I mean, this is a good point, and I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, and this is, you know, most of our applications that we sell people are written in C++. A lot of our developers are C++ developers.
Right.
We totally understand that, and further. But we recently had some videos on Channel 9, in fact, where they talked about the future of C++. And the future of C++, Visual C++, Microsoft
right.
Visual C++. It's been much more standards compliant than in the past, so we understood that mistake. And B, it's going to be less about interoperability with managed code and more about evolving the language and the libraries that are necessary, people such as yourself. So there is a commitment there, for sure.
Yeah.
So we
and we see that
you haven't ignored it. You hear that out there?
Yeah,
that's good.
We're glad you haven't ignored it, because it's certainly possible for an organization like Microsoft to just say, "Hey, guess what? Everybody needs to do, except for us, needs to do development in C Sharp now, and you know, support that in development tools." It would be maybe arguably suicidal.
There's certain things that don't make sense for you. I mean, you can write an operating system in C Sharp, Singularity. Right? That's a research kernel.
Sure.
Which is really, really interesting, but you can't run Office on it. Yeah. And you can't run applications on it. So my point is, I hear you, and the C++ team is still there.
Good.
I mean, we still have
some. I know they're there.
I mean, they still
doing very good work. it's more strategic direction that's a little scary, you know, a little
cool.
Scary.
Right on.
All for good reason. Managed code is a beautiful thing.
It is. I mean, a managed code is arguably, I mean, it's safer. It's hard to write unsafe, you know, from the losing control over a whole system because of memory corruption.
It's protectable.
It's protectable. It's understandable.
Also, it's a positive aspect.
You got it.
Yeah. And I mean, we even see this when we're looking for really good people in the marketplace. There's a lot of people that are very capable, of writing systems and software in something like C# or Java, that aren't necessarily going to be effective writing the same type of systems in C++. We need to worry more about the details, and you can bite yourself. So it's kind of like the Excel macro programmers who have become very good at creating business systems. They need something, and that's probably the 80% of the people who are programming out in the world are interacting with the computer in that way. And I think it's super valuable to kind of provide bulletproof capabilities for them.
Absolutely. But on the other hand, as you mentioned, and I can get, I know we get this. I mean, is use the right tool for the job.
Yeah.
You don't say. I mean, Microsoft doesn't have an edict. No one at Microsoft says don't use unmanaged code ever.
Right.
I mean, that would, like you said, are you kidding me? So, but use managed code where it makes sense. Right. It makes absolute sense in a server environment. That's why it was initially designed. It makes absolute sense for profound UIs like WPF, etc. So that's really good feedback, and I'm not going to edit that out. So how's that?
Love it. Thank you.
So let's talk. Enough about us. And what's your future looking like? I mean, where you guys want to go? What's what you can talk about?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm thinking. Like, what shall I talk about? The challenge of every development manager, CTO in the world. We're planning on being on. But I'd like to go into any organization and say, why are you not using this? I mean, we want to evolve the product to the point where there's absolutely no reason for an organization to not be using our frameworks and our tools and capabilities and our little lightweight system in order to save energy.
Sure.
So and it's almost an environmental imperative to do so. Mm-hmm. And so what we're looking at is just making sure that we work very well in lots of environments, that there's lightweight, that administration is very natural and lightweight, that the capabilities we provide are so much of a no-brainer to have both on an individual's desktop computer and for a whole enterprise, that there's no reason to not have our product. I mean, from anything from a financial to a just pure capability sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of the reason, I think it's almost a social imperative that we as a planet all work toward managing our footprints and the environment and,
absolutely,
and energy use and things like that. So we have that going for us. Now the only thing is, how are we going to fill in so that we don't need to waste this power?
Mm-hmm.
So that it's really a no-brainer for all sorts of organizations to just use it. Have it be zero touch, just a natural day-to-day part of doing business, and
cool,
and measurable, and so that you can actually say that you're doing something.
Absolutely, and it's a good thing. And I hope Microsoft buys your software.
Yeah,
come on, guys, let's do it.
Come on, guys.
So now, do you have any idea? I mean, you must of like what's the yearly carbon dioxide footprint of the United States. So how much, what percentage of the carbon dioxide emitted by the United States can you attribute to computers? That's a hard problem.
It is, and I I haven't memorized the numbers, but we do have some pretty solid figures. Oh, I actually remember a number now from our participation in the Green Grid that they're somewhere around 1.5% of all power in the U.S., all electrical power in the U.S. is consumed by large data centers. Okay. These are servers. And another number I've heard roughly equates the client loads to that. So we might say that about 1% of all power consumed in the U.S. Is by personal computers.
Sure.
So it's a portion of the overall thing, but you know the big consumers are things like heavy industry, utilities, aluminum smelters, and those type of organizations.
Sure.
But if you're trying to keep those industries up and running, you need to give them the power they need to do their job. So you need to look at where you can actually save the power.
Absolutely.
But even having a 0.5% impact, I mean, our software can easily frequently save like at least 0.5% of the energy. And in organizations that leave their machines on 24 hours a day, normally it's more like 2/3 of the energy that these PCs would normally consume.
Excellent.
So if you look at even saving at 0.5%, that's the equivalent of a generating capacity for, a million households in America? Mm-hmm. Just a vast number of people, and the infrastructure and the power capabilities related to it. And there's some very significant costs associated with that. And the greenhouse, you know, the greenhouse gas, nobody's going to be chopping 30% off our emissions, you know, with one initiative. It's going to be a series of things that look at the pragmatic places to save power, save wasted energy, and then doing projects to do them. We know that our measure for saving power is one of the lowest cost, easiest to install, fastest return things available for reducing CO2 emissions. So.
Excellent. So one last thing. When you talk about easy to install, so we're talking about you go into an enterprise and you install a centralized SQL server. Or so your application is going to have, in an enterprise, for example, it's going to have your SQL server to store information, policy, whatever's going on in there. And then Windows services with some desktop applications as well on the clients.
Yes.
Is that pretty much the...
Well, the other piece is there's a survey of server component that actually talks to the database. So the clients don't talk to the database directly.
Okay.
They talk through a server component, which is kind of the hub for administration and power policy settings and all the network connections that happen to transmit policies and send the usage data. So it's that server that's talking with SQL Server. In fact, we use a... In smaller customer sites with fewer than a couple thousand machines, we are even taking advantage of the SQL Server Express editions so that it just comes in. So smaller organizations can just click a button on an installer and have both the SQL Server and our server product up and running on a system, very lightweight, you know, no administrative overhead to it at all.
Nice.
So that's a good thing. I like the standalone SQL Server 2005. Of course, that means any larger organization with multiple thousands will be buying a license for SQL Server, so, or using a database that's already in place, which we really commonly find.
Okay, but the database part isn't as big of a deal, of course, as the client and server to you, right?
It's a store. I mean, it's not as central to the system maybe as it would be in a business system. Accounts payable or an AR system or something like that. But we have a lot of data that we're managing and settings, and it's so efficient to use a higher level store like SQL Server and not worry about, you know, B-tree databases or flat file storage or anything like that. We couldn't get the scalability we wanted by doing it ourselves. So we're in a world of agile software development, and we need to rely on components in order to get work done quickly. And SQL databases are one of the critical components for any, you know, data management oriented software. And you know, our customers all have Windows servers, they already all have SQL Server databases, and they're really comfortable with our choice of that as the database that we support.
Cool. Well, it's a world class database. So.
It is, it certainly is.
Those guys are some of our smartest engineers.
Well, that's a good thing too.
Of course, now I'm going to get in trouble for saying that because, you know, you can say the same for the Windows kernel people. You can say the same for the people, the compiler people in C++ world, whatever. I shouldn't say that. But
well, I'll tell you,
I'm impressed with that team.
My boss in the last company her name is Denise Draper, and she's a manager inside of the SQL Server unit inside of Microsoft. She is one smart cookie. Yeah, Microsoft is very lucky to have her.
Excellent. Well, hey, I think, without sounding cheesy, I think the world's lucky to have you guys because this is important. There's only going to be a growth in the amount of computers
as people rely on them more. So when you think about houses becoming much more digital, there's going to be computers running that. There'll be computers running your entertainment system. Do you want to have it running while you're not watching stuff? Exactly. No, you don't.
Exactly.
So it's this is timely and very important in this world of where things are going to start getting more like Venus if we don't get our oxygen.
Yeah, we don't want that. Venus is awfully warm during the days.
Yeah, we don't want Venus. But hey, I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks. We're very excited about what we're doing.
Cool.
We feel both a business imperative and an ecological imperative to succeed. So
good.
And I think our customers do too.
Excellent. Well, I mean, economy and ecology can work together.
There is a way.
Good
There's
example.
A path. There's a path.
Perfect. Well, hey, great to meet you.
Thank you very much. Nice talking with you.
Nice talking with you.
Take care.
You too.